Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber, your host. On today's show, email privacy. Is it finally happening? Will Congress finally protect the privacy of Americans' emails? Will law enforcement finally be required to get a warrant before accessing our cloud storage? These sound like obvious things, but they've taken a really long time to come to be. Joining me to discuss this is Big Brother and President of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you for joining me.
I can't think of anything funny to say, so thanks for having me.
Well, after that awkward pause, let's get into the show.
We'll edit out the pause. It'll sound totally natural.
So, Baron, what we're talking about today is something that we talked about on episode 15 of this podcast with Chris Calabrese of the Center for Democracy and Technology. But there have finally been some actual developments in the long-standing battle to protect the privacy of Americans' emails and other stored electronic communications. But just to bring listeners up to speed who may not have heard episode 15, we're talking about the 1986 Electronic Communications and Privacy Act. And we're talking about reforming that law. What is it, and what's the problem with that law?
Yeah, so if you store files on your computer, they're protected by the Fourth Amendment. The government has to get a warrant if law enforcement wants to come in and read them. So in other words, the Fourth Amendment, for constitutional purposes, doesn't distinguish between technologies. And that's exactly right. It shouldn't matter whether it's paper or digital. The problem is that if you store stuff on someone else's computer, which is essentially how most computing today, if not all of the things that we do, work, that's not covered at all by the Fourth Amendment. And that's because of Supreme Court decisions that go back to the 1960s and 70s. And so in the 80s, recognizing that this was going to be a problem, Congress passed the law that you mentioned, ECPA, in order to deal with this. But of course, at the time, the internet was still a very niche thing that was being used really only at universities. The thing that Congress contemplated was remote processing of data. So companies would put data on a tape and they would send it out by U.S. Postal Service and they'd get it back in 3 weeks. And that was what Congress essentially legislated for. And so when they wrote the statute, they wrote in all these sort of quasi-warrant requirements, but only for data that had been stored for a limited time and depending on whether it had been opened and blah, blah, blah. And so the point was that even by 2000, people recognized that Americans were going to start putting a lot of stuff in the cloud. So Hotmail was a thing. You didn't have permanent storage, so you couldn't keep stuff forever. But the Republican Congress moved a bill that would have at least extended the warrant protection to stuff that was held for a year. And that bill passed in committee. It was about to go somewhere, and then 9/11 happened, and everything froze. And then we had the next 10 years, essentially, of inactivity when people were putting more and more stuff into the cloud.
And there's kind of an arbitrary rule that the Email Privacy Act, the bill that will be marked up today by the House Judiciary Committee, that is one of the fixes here. And it's something about emails that are stored or that are 180 days old. So maybe in 1986, something like that might have been relevant. But today, 30 years after the passage of ECPA, clearly an email being stored for 180 days doesn't mean a damn thing. I mean, people have email accounts going back over 10 years. So what is the 180-day rule and why is it so silly?
Well, originally it was about the expectation of privacy. And the idea was somehow that if you left a file too long on a remote server that you had given up some expectation. And so Congress said, well, for that, law enforcement shouldn't have to get a warrant. That's a stupid rule. It doesn't make any sense anymore, and it hasn't for a long time. And the Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit essentially said so back in 2011 when they decided the Warshak case, late 2010, ruling that the Fourth Amendment did apply to stuff that was held in the cloud. And that in turn really created some pressure to finally do something about this. The Department of Justice eventually came around to saying, okay, well, we don't have to get a warrant under ECPA, but we're going to anyway. So they dealt with some of the problem just by changing their practice. Of course, that didn't address what state law enforcement could do, nor did it set right the example that we were setting for the rest of the world. But the point is that we have spent 6 years working on getting this set of reforms passed. It was 6 years ago at the end of March that the Digital Due Process Coalition started. And that's something that has brought together groups across the political spectrum, built an unbelievable amount of support in the House of Representatives. We now have 315 representatives. That's 72% of the entire House that support this bill. And the whole thing has been stalled because in the Senate, the issue had gotten tied up about whether civil agencies should get exemptions and a few other sort of nitty-gritty little details. And the House Judiciary Committee had essentially not been moving the bill, and now it's finally moving, and they're going to have a markup on this today.
So we'll get into the civil agency carve-out in a little bit, but it's worth noting that this law was passed in 1986. It is incredible that as the commercial internet has developed and email and cloud storage have really just eclipsed any sort of rationale for a law like this, that nothing has moved. And really, the Digital Due Process Coalition was about surveillance reform before surveillance reform was even cool. 2010, this is before the Snowden revelations. So these groups were on top of this issue before the groundswell that the Snowden revelations brought to light about government surveillance, because this is about domestic surveillance. This is often about your local law enforcement agency. It's also about agencies like the IRS, and it's just about basic Fourth Amendment protections. But as you mentioned, a series of court decisions made it so that the Fourth Amendment did not apply here. But so let's actually get into the civil agency carve-out, because that's an important issue. The reason that this has been held up for so long is that groups like the IRS, the SEC, even the EPA, regulatory agencies, see it as a major burden that they would have to get a warrant to look at emails or other stored communications. Many of them complain they don't have criminal warrant authority. They can only use subpoenas. So what are they so worried about? What is the Federal Trade Commission, a group we often criticize on the show? Why are they so concerned about a warrant requirement for email? I mean, this is basic constitutional protections, right?
The civil agencies had a valid concern in some respects. They wanted to make sure that companies were not able to hide their internal emails, their internal files, simply by putting them into the cloud. And so what this bill that is being marked up today does is to say, look, if you, as a private company, if you put stuff into the cloud, that isn't changed by this. You still have to respond when the government asks you to produce that information. But the bill doesn't give a carve out to civil agencies. It does say that in general, they can't go to, say, Gmail and ask Gmail to turn over all of the emails or the Slack messages or whatever the cloud storage service is. It could be Dropbox, it could be other forms of communication, that if they want to do that, that requires a warrant. So in other words, the House has essentially said no to a carve-out for civil agencies while preserving the basic tools that civil agencies need. And this now sets up a fight with the Senate, and it remains to be seen what will happen. It is entirely possible that this issue will simply stall and that today's markup and even a quick House vote to approve this, which is certainly what will happen after the markup, will be another false dawn for ECPA reform.
And it may sound like just a wonky distinction, you know, oh, what do I care if these regulatory agencies get a carve out? But it is highly concerning that an agency like the IRS could potentially produce electronic communications simply with a subpoena, which is different than a warrant. A warrant implies some type of criminal investigation that you're looking into. And I mean, a few years ago, it was brought to light that the IRS was going after Tea Party nonprofits and things like that. So for nonprofits who are engaged in policymaking, do they have a valid reason to be really concerned about the IRS asking for a carve-out? And is there really a big difference between a subpoena and a warrant and how easy it is to get one versus the other?
Well, the big issue here is, so let's think about how a normal investigation works. If the IRS is investigating your company, you have the opportunity, and they're asking for documents that you have, you have the opportunity to challenge their request as overbroad, to refuse to produce certain things because they're purely personal. So as a matter of reality, most Americans probably mingle their work and personal email accounts. There are many Americans who probably don't have a personal email account and who use their work account that way. And if you are in a normal situation where you're producing documents in response to an agency, you would remove the stuff about your boss having an affair, for example, because it's not relevant in 99% of cases to the insider trading case that the SEC might bring. Conceivably could be. There are cases where that, you know, should be actually something the government should get. But, but generally speaking, there's an opportunity for the company to weigh in about protecting privacy. But in the worst case scenario that we were worried about, you could imagine that civil agencies could have gone to web companies willy-nilly and just said, well, we have a subpoena that we've issued on our own, really, without convincing a judge that there was probable cause to believe there was a violation of law. And we're ordering you to turn over all of the correspondence from this company that you, whose information you host. I mean, just think about Slack, right? So we have Tech Freedom runs on Slack. Our private Slack channel, our random channel, has all kinds of stuff in there that is just about stupid things that we say. We
share funny photos with each other. It has nothing to do with work. And even if there were a legitimate inquiry into us for whatever reason, that stuff should not be relevant and subpoenaed and, you know.
Yeah, and I raise this example because we're a nonprofit. It's a little bit different from another company, but it's worth just noting right now that the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of the other core founding members of the Digital Due Process Coalition, is right now in the midst of litigation with the Attorney General of the U.S. Virgin Islands, which has attempted to subpoena all of CEI's internal discussions for a period of 10 years in order to see whether Exxon had some improper role in supporting CEI's skeptical work about climate change. Well, setting aside the merits of that case, it's an example of an AG trying to bully a private organization that happens to be a nonprofit. And the point is that kind of thing could happen if civil agencies were able to go around and bypass the organization itself and say, just give us all of the private information that this company held, and it might include, in the worst case scenario, it might include, for example, the Twitter accounts of employees, because the law enforcement agency might say, well, those are used for both work and personal. Anyway, the point is, all of that stuff has been taken off the table by the House bill, which once again says, generally speaking, you have to get a warrant, even if you're a civil agency, but if you go after the target directly, the target can't hide its own information by saying, well, we host our internal messaging on Slack or Google, they will still have to provide it. And that's the way it should be. So that ensures that law enforcement can continue to go after bad actors without creating a carve out from the warrant requirement.
So today, the bill will be marked up, and just in the interest of defining our DC technical jargon for listeners who don't spend all of their days reading about House and Senate procedure, what is a markup?
It just means that both sides get to introduce amendments. So any member on the committee can propose them. The committee will vote. And when the committee is done, they will send the marked up bill to the full House. And here, given that there is so much support for it, we would expect that there would be a vote very quickly. And it's important to note that normally whether there's a vote is up to the discretion of the speaker. But in this particular case, there are so many supporters. Again, it's 315 out of 435 that if there were any delay, you could see a discharge petition, which essentially never happens anymore. But this could be the one bill where it actually does get moved.
Media coverage seems to suggest that because the bill has over 300 co-sponsors, it's had that level of support for a long time. It's only grown since the civil agencies had been successful in blocking the bill. But as we mentioned, that issue has been resolved.
In the Senate.
Right. Yeah. So now we're talking about the bill sailing through the House, but the Senate is less civil libertarian in general than the House and is usually more skeptical of surveillance reform, even domestic surveillance reform, even basic things like making sure the Fourth Amendment applies to electronic communications. And the Senate was also the vehicle that many of the regulatory agencies used to block the bill. When the Senate was controlled by Democrats, the Commerce Committee was headed up by Senator Jay Rockefeller. We had argued in a blog post, I believe, that he had been bottlenecking the bill because of, you know, he was kind of agreeing with the FTC and other agencies that it would be such a burden to have a warrant requirement. Assuming that the reports are right and that the bill sails through the House, how do you see this fight playing out in the Senate?
Well, it's everything you just said is really about the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, it's also true that Senator Rockefeller, who was chairman of the Commerce Committee, a ranking member, that he had also used that perch to try to defend the Federal Trade Commission, which is really his pet agency in a sense. So it's not clear what's going to happen. The Senate Republicans are going to have to make some decisions here. I suspect that if anything, they may be a little bit more careful about the politics of this, because the Senate Judiciary Committee is taking a lot of flack for not moving forward the president's nominee for the Supreme Court.
Right.
And if I were Chuck Grassley, who is now actually facing a potentially plausible Democratic challenger back home in Iowa, I would really want to do something that attracted bipartisan support and showed that the Senate Judiciary Committee could move. And so stalling on ECPA reform would be pretty much the last thing that I would want to do.
Yeah, if you're Chuck Grassley and you're facing a Senate election that is going to favor Democrats because more Republican seats are up for election than Democrat seats, and you've got...
That's not the only reason.
Right, but then you've also got the fact that Democrats turn out more in the presidential years than in the midterm elections. So for a lot of reasons, it would be potentially a really bad political blunder to be seen as a surveillance hawk when you've got a credible Democrat challenging you. Now, let's talk about what this bill doesn't do, because this is hardly the end of the road for surveillance reform. There's so much more that needs to be done. And something that's often talked about as a companion bill or an amendment to email privacy is location privacy. Now we're talking about GPS. We're talking about what kind of data the government collects on your location. And as most listeners use smartphones, they are often being monitored by the apps they use for commercial purposes. But of course, that data could also be collected by the government for surveillance purposes. So, Barron, do you see someone introducing an amendment to ECPA reform today that would try to tie the issue of location privacy to the issue of email privacy?
Yeah, so I would invite everyone to go look at digitaldueprocess.org. Again, that's the big tent coalition that was started 6 years ago. DDP has four principles, and the most important ones are warrant for content, which this bill would do, and warrant for geolocation, which this bill does not touch.
Right.
There are separate bills that have been floated by Democrats and Republicans. There are two main versions of that. Each of them is bipartisan, that have been floated to deal with the geolocation issue. I suspect very strongly that you will see the most interesting part of the markup today being about this question of adding geolocation to this bill. And it's possible that that actually might happen. And in a way, it might be the House saying to the Senate, look, we're moving the goalposts. So not only do you have to meet us on the civil agency stuff and all the warrant for content, but we would like to go even further. And it's possible that if they do that, that maybe that gets dropped in the Senate and that the geolocation thing happens later. But at least it might be a way of, for the House to give itself something to bargain with.
So that could go two ways. That could be a smart move, like you suggest, where because they move the goalpost, they make it an even more reform-minded bill, then they have a chip to give up. They can say, okay, we'll take geolocation off the table if you take the email privacy bill as is and not try to muck it up or reinstall the civil agency carve-out. Or it could be seen as a bridge too far, and you might turn off some senators if they see this as, oh, you're just tacking things on at the 11th hour, and now we're done talking. But there's also a state angle here, Barron. I just wanted to clarify, because I talked to Chris about this on episode 15. A bunch of states are taking this matter into their own hands, because as you mentioned, this has been going on for so long. California passed and signed into law basically a version of this bill. I'm not sure if the location thing was included. New York, the ACLU is doing some work there about ECPA reform. Would this federal ECPA bill supplant those bills? If the state bills are even more privacy-minded, would it replace that? I mean, how does the relationship between the state and federal ECPA reform efforts play out?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the states would be preempted here by the federal legislation. But again, the important point is that I don't think many of the states have attempted to deal with the geolocation bill issue. That is more complicated, because here, the simplest way to think about this is the content issue is pretty straightforward. You're just saying if it's content, it needs to have a warrant for law enforcement to get access to it. Geolocation's not so clear, because everybody agrees that at some level of of granularity, it's really sensitive. But if it's remote enough, maybe it's not. And so the question, the most important question, is where you draw the line. And if nothing else, I think the best argument for federal legislation is having a consistent line drawn across America, so that it's not a patchwork for law enforcement to have to figure out from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Right. And if the basic idea is that these laws are correcting a hole in the Fourth Amendment, really, like the extending the principle of a warrant requirement to the online realm in places that it hasn't existed yet, it makes sense that these would be federal matters, that the states should not be taking it upon themselves, or city by city, town by town, taking it upon themselves to decide what is required for a warrant and what is not. But in terms of next steps, we mentioned the markup today. Assuming that the news reports are right and that there's no last-minute controversial amendments, this should be a slam dunk in the House. The Senate, if you're asking yourself, what can I do, whether you support this bill or not, you have two senators in your state, let them know what you think. Tweet at them, call them, whatever you want to do. Barron, any parting thoughts before we end the show?
Yeah, I would just say that this really puts in front of Speaker Ryan and the Senate Republican leadership the question of do they get tech? Do they want to actually use tech issues as an opportunity to build consensus and show that they can govern, and that they can build bipartisan support and use it, and that they can actually speak to America's youth and tech sector? I mean, this is being handed to them on a silver platter. It really couldn't be any easier. And yet here we are 6 years later, where only finally have the Republicans managed to push this forward. If they get this across the finish line on the markup and then stumble by not putting it up for a House vote quickly, not getting essentially a unanimous House vote, which it really ought to. I don't know of anybody in the House that's actually opposed this bill. So if they can't do that, and if the Senate Republicans can't get Chuck Grassley to push this through the committee and get this thing wrapped up and sent to the president, that bodes very poorly for what it means for Republicans to be able to govern, and to govern on tech in particular.
Well, that's it for today's show. Barron, thank you for making me stay late to record a podcast.
Yeah, it's really brutal that you have to stay till 6:30.
Which... Well, I meant late in the nonprofit sense.
Yeah, right.
Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.